Hi, I'm Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I've been sober since January the 1st of 1973. I don't have a lot of personal credit for that, but I didn't drink, and I tried to do the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been subject to Al-Anon supervision for a year and a half before I got here. My wife overreacted quite a lot, and she tried to get me in while I was still a little green. But ultimately, she had to have some friend or family member who was an alcoholic to go to Al-Anon. So I made this sacrifice. I'd like for you to meet this lady. Her name is Billy. We've been married for 54 years. I don't know why she stayed, but I knew I could never find anything better, so I just hung on to what I had. I want to thank the committee, and Harlan, whether you're on the committee or not on the committee, I want to thank you too. I love coming up here to this part of the country. I've been here before, as you know. And I guess some of you didn't get it, so you came back, and I'm going to try to give it to you again. So pay close attention. We've been treated wonderfully here. This is a fine conference, as good as I've ever been to. They've treated us very nice. We've had many, many nice things. The food's been outstanding. Everything's good. Just wonderful. And thank you so much. It's a real honor to be asked to talk to a group like you. It really is. It's not that, you know, I have no better sobriety than most of you. But it's an honor to be able to share your life with some people that appreciate and understand what you're talking about. I listened to a lady the other day who was an Al-Anon. She was born with serious birth defect. And we were talking in this meeting about what was the one gift that the program had given us that we most appreciated. And of course, there were a lot of good answers to that. Sobriety, peace of mind, all that sort of thing. And it came to her and she said she thought the greatest gift she had been given was the gift of learning to appreciate and use resistance. Because without resistance, nothing happens. She gave the example of the bird or the airplane. It flies because of the resistance to the wind or the air. She talked about the bow and arrow. The bow sends the arrow through the air because of the resistance that's created when you pull it back and turn it loose. And all through life, we encounter resistance. I hit a little, did you? Mine started early, very early. I can't even remember all the times it started, but when I got here and became aware, and as far back as I can remember, there's always been something standing in my way a little bit. A little resistance to where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. I was born in a farm out in West Texas. Wheat farm. Know a lot about wheat. Know about tractors. Started driving one when I was 10 years old. I had a father who was not adverse to a little violence when it suited his purpose. When I misbehaved. My dad was a master at putting pressure on people like me. He would snatch me up sometimes and give me a whipping for what I did. And mostly, looking back, I deserved what I got. And then other times he would tell me, he would look at me and say, "I'm too mad to whip you now. I'll whip you in a day or two." And I would ultimately wind up and saying, "Could we do it today?" And sometimes he would let me off the hook, and sometimes he wouldn't. Clarence, was my father, was a hard taskmaster. His guiding principle in life is somebody's got to do it. Whatever it was, if he saw it needed to be done, somebody's got to do it, and it might as well be me. And he'd go get it, and he didn't mind volunteering me for whatever needed to be done. My mother's was a little Irishman. She was much softer. And hers was, you can do anything you have to do. Do anything you have to do. So I grew up doing whatever needed to be done and knowing that I could do anything I had to do. Started driving that tractor in World War II came around. All that able-bodied men went to war. And I wasn't the only kid in the community that was driving a tractor at 10 years old. But that didn't keep making an easier job for me. It felt a lot of pressure. My dad absolutely insisted on things being done right, just exactly the way he thought they ought to be. And so I had a lot of pressure on me. That was among the first resistance that I can recall. And I responded to that by trying very, very hard to please that man for a while. A little later on, I got a little less interested in doing that, but I tried it hard for a while. Now, when you get loaded up right way with a lot of pressure, you've got to find some way to release it. I found the ways to release it were irresponsibility. I had responsibility to work to please my father, but when I got away from him out in the community, I could be irresponsible, and it was a wonderful thing. Irresponsibility cropped up in things like driving as fast as I could drive down dirt roads, highways, whatever there was. We later developed the habit of, we carried a lot of guns with us. We were always hunting something. There wasn't a hell of a lot to hunt in West Texas sometimes, but we had the guns. And so you have the guns and you need to shoot them. And so we developed a little game of shooting mailboxes while we were going by at about 70 or 80 miles an hour. Take some skill to hit one of those things. And we got letters, and there were little articles in the paper telling the boys on Rural Route 2 we were going to go to, it was a violation of a federal law to do that. But that didn't slow us down much. But one day, an old farmer, a neighbor of ours, came up to my dad and said, Dad and I were in town, and Big Bad Bovina, not a lot of you haven't heard of that place, but it's about 1.75 miles from the center of the universe. He came up and he said, boys, how are you doing? We said, fine. He said, Clarence, I want to tell you something. This boy, Jerry, is the damnedest shot you ever seen in your life. And Dad said, really? He kind of perked up a little bit. And he said, yeah. He said, he was riding in a car going down that dirt road out there in front of my house. They must have been doing 70, 75 miles an hour. And old Jerry rolled down the front window on the passenger side of that car, popped that .22 rifle out the window, and put three holes in a little tank I had out there that you could put your hat over those three holes. Damnedest shot I ever saw. Dad got real quiet for a minute, and he said, he'll be over and fix that this afternoon. And that ended my shooting for quite a long time. But I continued to do work like hell, get off work, and I wanted to be wild and woolly and full of fleas and never been curried below the knees. That was what my goal in life was, you know. And I got to college. They sent me to college. I didn't really know why I was going, but everybody told me I ought to go to college. My superintendent of my school and his wife told me when I got ready to graduate that I ought to go to college. Told me I ought to either be a coach or a lawyer. And I forgot both of those for a long time, because when I got to college, I ran across something that really helps out with irresponsibility. It's called booze. It comes in various forms. Jack talked about it. It's different colors. And we generally kind of start at the top and work our way down, but I started in kind of the middle and would go any direction that I could get any booze. We got good at getting booze, and I loved drinking. I blacked out almost immediately. I thought everybody blacked out. And I could get positively excited about getting drunk a week from tonight. We're going to get drunk. We're going to pool our money and buy some booze, put some gas in a car, and there's no damn telling where we'll be the next morning. And there wasn't. Generally, the first question we ask the next morning is, where the hell are we? Followed closely by, what did we do? Nobody had a real answer to either one of those questions. But we kind of pieced things together, and we'd get it ready. But I was the guy in my bunch who always said, let's do it again. Let's do it again. I liked it. I liked where we did it. I liked who we did it with. I didn't even mind the hangovers. But I just loved to drink. And I was never, ever going to give that up. It did something for me. You know, I didn't think about being, I was kind of a cocky kid anyway, but I didn't feel like it did anything to me internally, really. It just, I liked doing it. And if you like doing something, why the hell aren't you going to do it? So I did it. It didn't please people. I had friends of mine that I went to college with came around and told me, said, Jerry, they wouldn't appreciate what you're doing back home. And I said, I watched those two guys that talked to me about that. They were classmates of mine in high school. And I told them they just had to kind of mind their own business because I was doing something that I really kind of liked to do. And as they walked away, I remembered thinking, I wonder why in the hell they don't like to do this. So they left me alone. I began to lose friends as I went along, find people that didn't appreciate my kind of fun. My wife was one of those kind of people that didn't appreciate my kind of fun. She was a nice girl. She only went out with nice boys. I very early developed a reputation for being kind of unstable. And you wouldn't want to take me home to your mother a lot of times. We became friends though. She came in from California. California girl on the West Texas campus. My God, she's a pretty good looking chick, let me tell you. I saw her and I lighted up right away. I decided I'd get close to that lady, and of me, she would have none. That's the way the Bible would put it. But she would occasionally need a car. And she had asked me if she could borrow my car for a little bit, and I would agree, certainly you may use my car. And we worked out kind of a barter system. I didn't go to class a lot. And it's hard to pass tests the first thing I did after I bought my books was walk around to the other side of the bookstore and sell them. Because it looked like to my dad I was buying my books and I was getting some money for partying. I took a pretty good discount, but it was worth it. So when you don't have a book and you don't go to class a lot, it's difficult to pass the classes. And my wife went to class, some of the same classes I went to, and she took good notes. And the day or two before the final, I could take her notes and read them and, you know, improvise a little and get by. I wasn't trying to make the honor roll. You got to understand that. I just was trying to get by. And so we worked that out. We stayed with that for a while. I went to the Navy after I got out of college. I didn't know I was going to graduate. Didn't intend to graduate. Why in the hell would anybody want to graduate from college when they bring a new crop of freshman girls in every year? It's an ideal situation. They need to be shown the ropes. Somebody's got to help them, and I was willing to help them. But I got out, got in the Navy, and came back by and met my wife and talked to her, and she was nice enough to write me a letter one time while I was up in Newport, Rhode Island in the Navy, and we said hello, and we started writing each other, and I went off and got on a ship and went over to Japan and the South Pacific, and we continued to write. And when I came back home, she met me in California. She actually, her family lived there at the time, and We started dating, and I hadn't seen a round-eyed girl for quite a while. And like I said, she's a pretty good-looking old gal, round-eyed or not. And she, I was attracted to her. And she thought I had grown up, and she got some kind of an idea that I was not going to drink after we got married. I have no idea where the hell that came from, because I know I was never drunk enough to say that. I was never horny enough to say that. Anyhow, we got married. We had a son while I was in the Navy. I didn't have any plans for where to go. I've always just kind of followed my nose. And got out of the Navy and didn't have any place to go. Went back to West Texas. While I'd been overseas, she'd stayed with my mother and father and kind of got acquainted with them. They got along real good. And we came back there, and I went down to the University of Texas and to ask them if I could go to law school. I remembered what that coach or that superintendent had told me, so I decided, well, I might be a lawyer. And I went into the registrar's office, and she said, "Did you graduate from college?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And I had my little piece of paper that said I graduated. And she said, "Did you ever take the law school aptitude test?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I did while I was out there in California, just before I got out. I took that test. And I don't know how good I did on it. Is that a good score or a bad score?" She said, "Well, it's okay." I said, "Well, could I go to school here?" And she said, "Yes, I'm going to go talk to the dean and we'll ask you." And the dean said yes, and I started school about 3 weeks later. Wife and kids living in less than luxurious facilities. We had a bunch of old army barracks that they leased to the people, and I went through law school. I didn't drink much in law school. I drank a lot in the Navy, but I was at sea a lot, so I didn't drink much when I was at sea, but I drank pretty good at home. We began to have some trouble along about that time with how much I drank. She's been oversensitive about the use of alcohol for as long as I've known her. We got out of law school and went to Dallas, and I got a good job down in Dallas, a good law firm, and I could almost support my family with that job, and we were getting along pretty good, I thought. I stop occasionally and have a few beers with the boys after work, and one night I came home and she was crying, and she said, "I can't live like this. You're coming in all hours of the night. I don't know where you are, what you're doing. We have children," or I had a son by then. So I quit going out partying. I just brought my disease home with me. Let everybody there share it. And we kept going that way, and the conversation more and more drifted to how much I drank, and when I drank, who I drank with, and it got very serious a time or two. Serious enough that I sent her to see a psychiatrist about her her oversensitivity to alcohol. And she went. That shows you how sick she was. She went, and they wanted to see me after a while. I don't really know why, but I guess he thought he needed a little help with her, but I went to see him, and we talked about football, and we talked about all kinds of things. We never talked much about drinking. He asked if I drank, and I said, "Oh, yeah, I drink a little." And he didn't probe too deeply into that area. He asked if we had any trouble with money, and I said, "Yes, we have a lot of problems with money. My wife spends more than I make." And he said, "Well, you guys need to work on the drinking and money end of your marriage." Oh, well, I thought that would solve the problem, but she kept going back to him every once in a while. And it all had to do with this drinking thing. And she sent off and got tests from the Texas Commission on Alcohol and gave me the damn test. Now, I'm good at taking tests. And I read the questions all over first, to see what the scope of this examination was going to cover. I had an objective in mind. I did not want to appear to be an alcoholic, but I was willing to be a heavy drinker. So I very carefully selected the questions that I was going to answer and which way I was going to answer them, and I came out just right on the mark. I was a heavy drinker, not an alcoholic. That slowed her down for a little while. But she is tenacious, if she's nothing else. My God, she gets on something and she hangs in there like you wouldn't believe. And I kept drinking more and more, almost all of it at home. Occasionally, when I could, I'd drink at lunch. Very busy in my law practice. Right away, I tried to be an office lawyer for a little while, but I couldn't tell whether I was winning or losing. I needed not to be a loser. That was one of my values. Don't be a loser. I used to think I cared a lot about winning, but I didn't care so much about winning as I did not losing. I can remember all the cases I ever lost. I can remember who the lawyer was on the other side, who the judge was, what the witnesses said, but I can't remember a lot of cases that I tried that came out favorable to my client. And when I tried that office thing for a little while, you can tell whether you're winning or losing when you're a trial lawyer. And so I became a trial lawyer, and that's the way I finished up my career. Billy continued to bug me about drinking. And I tried to be moderate in my drinking. I just drank what I needed. And that didn't seem to ever satisfy her. Then she did something that was totally, totally without my permission. She went to a thing called Al-Anon. She didn't tell me she was going. She didn't ask me what I thought about her going. She just went. And if they ever get you in that program for a little while, it's hell to get them out, I'll tell you that. My daughter one night, I didn't care where Billy was most of the time except when I needed something. And when I needed something, I wanted her right there. And I needed something one night, and I said to my daughter, "Where's your mother?" And Karen's a little girl, and she said, "I don't know, Daddy. She might have gone to one of those meetings." And I said, "What kind of meeting is that, Karen?" And she said, "I don't know, Dad. It's some kind of a family meeting." Well, at this particular point in time, we had agreed that we had agreed to disagree. If we didn't get any better in 6 months, we'd just go ahead and get a divorce. And it occurred to me, if my wife was going to secret family meetings, I probably needed a representative present at one of those meetings. There's no telling what the hell they were talking about there. And my wife came in, and she said, I said, "Where have you been?" And when she answered that question, I knew where we were going. She said, "Out." "Out where?" "To a shopping center." "Which one?" "Preston." "What did you do there?" "Met with some friends." "Who were they?" "You wouldn't know them." "What did you and your friends discuss?" "Well, we just shared our experience, hopes, and fears." And I kept going. I was good at cross-examining. She is the most difficult witness I ever cross-examined. When she doesn't want to give you the answer she knows you want, it's like trying to hit a snake with an ice pick. It's very difficult to do. So I kept asking questions and closing the gap and narrowing the field. Finally, I got down and I got this word, Al-Anon. What would be an Al-Anon? I'd never heard the word before. But we were pretty hostile at one another about that time. and I decided I'd make my best guess. And I decided probably Al-Anon had to do with aluminum kitchen utensils. She was quick to explain that it did not. I thought maybe she'd got a job and gone to work. Hell knows I'd been trying to get her to do that for years and years, and she wouldn't do it. But then the floodgate opened, and she had to tell me more about Al-Anon than I ever wanted to know in my entire life. It was a wonderful organization. Everyone was welcome. It appealed to all kinds of people. The only thing that we had in common, really, was that you needed a friend or family member who had a problem with alcohol. Ding! My wife has taken what she thinks is my problem to a public meeting where everybody is welcome. This is not a good thing. Nobody, not even drunks, want a drunk lawyer. Well, I sobered up almost instantly. And I sat her down in her chair, and I got her to gaze deeply into my eyes. And I said, "Billy, we must talk seriously about this thing." And she said, "All right." And I said, "Have you noticed that I'm the only one who brings any money to this house?" Yeah, she knew that. "Do you realize that we owe money on almost everything? The cars, the house, the furniture?" Yes, she knew that. "Do you know what happens if you stop paying the monthly payments on those?" "What happens?" "They come and get them. Whatever they are, they come and get them. If my partners find out that you think I'm an alcoholic, they will kick me out of that firm the next day. We've already got two alcoholics in there, and they're figuring ways to try to get rid of them right now. I'm younger than they are, less experienced than they are, and have a lot less client base than they do. And they're going to kick me out, and the money will stop. So we're not talking about money to send our kids to college. We're talking about surviving in the middle of the damn winter, naked on the streets of Dallas with our kids. All because you're going to that damned Al-Anon thing. You got to quit going to Al-Anon." And she said, I think I need to go." No, you don't need to go. You must not go." She said, "I think I'm going to go." So I said something loving to her like that, "Well, if you go to another one of them damn meetings and I find out about it, I'll kill you as sure as hell." And she said, "I'm going." And she did. That was bad enough. But she got a thing called a sponsor, who was one of the meanest, most insensitive women I've ever heard of in my life. I never got to see her, really. She was always just on the other end of the telephone. This didn't exactly happen, but it was like I was left alone in my house. The kids were in bed. The only thing in that house that's awake and alive is me and my dog. My wife comes in from one of those damn meetings, and I say, Billy, I've been thinking. Only thing that loves me is this dog." And she said, "I'm going to call my sponsor." And she did. And she came back a few minutes later and she said, "My sponsor says you're right." "You're right. Everybody ought to have two things, and we're going to get you another dog." We battled incessantly over getting her out of Al-Anon. I tried every damn thing I could think of to get that woman out, to leave that thing alone. Every day I went to work, I expected somebody was going to call me into the office and say, "We hear your wife thinks you're an alcoholic. She's been going to public meetings talking about your drunkenness. You're out." Well, I'd get through another day and nobody'd say anything. On the way home, I'd think, got by that day, got to get her out of that damn place one way or the other. So, one night on the way home, I don't know, y'all probably ever never do this, but sometimes I decide to start a fight. I just make up my mind before I get there, we're going to be a damn fight. This was one of those nights. Now, you got to be careful when you do this because you want to get all the good things, all the information you can from them, all the admissions you want from them before you ever let them know there's a fight. So I walked in. I said, "How are you, darling?" And she said, "I'm fine." I said, "How? Dinner smells good." "Oh, yes, good, nice dinner. How are the kids?" "The kids are fine." How's the dog?" "The dog's fine." I said, "Billy, I've been thinking. You think I'm an alcoholic?" And she said, "I don't know whether you are or not." I said, "Well, that's damn funny. You've been calling me an alcoholic for a long time." And she said, "Yes, but I was wrong." It doesn't matter whether I think you're an alcoholic or not. It doesn't matter whether your mother and father think you've got a drinking problem. It doesn't matter what your partners think, what our friends think. It matters only what you think. Because if you don't think you have a drinking problem, you'll never do anything about it. I was not expecting that answer. I had no defense against that answer. But it raised a question which I had thought a lot about. I was drinking about a quart of whiskey a day, every day, plus a little I'd get at lunch sometimes. And I wondered, I didn't know anybody else that was drinking quite that much. So I asked the question, I said, "Well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it?" The jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. She said, "I've been reading a book written by the first woman member of Alcoholics Anonymous named Marty Mann. And in that book, she tells you how you can determine whether you are or are not an alcoholic. And she says the one way you could do it is just quit entirely." She said, "I don't think you want to do that." And I said, no, I don't want to do that." She said, "Well, the other thing you can do is try some controlled drinking." "What in the hell is that?" She said, "Well, she says you should take 2 drinks a day. Every day, never change that, just 2 drinks a day. And if you can do that for 6 months and never exceed the 2 drinks, you are not an alcoholic." I said, let me understand. You've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years, and now you want me to continue drinking for another 6 months. And she said, yes. And I realized I'm dealing with a sick woman. And I'm not going anywhere with this fight that I started. And I'm getting the hell out of there. And I said, "That's the dumbest test I've ever heard in my life," and walked off. But, I didn't want that divorce. I love my kids and I love my wife, and I realized that we were just impasse on this drinking issue. And I'm responsible, remember? I'm responsible. I've run into resistance here, massive resistance. The way I've always dealt with resistance is through life is I drink and I get away from it for one day. And I avoid it, or I think I'm avoiding it, only it stacks up over time. And over time it got to where my rule was if I ever got in trouble anywhere in Dallas, I never went back to that place again. And there was a lot of places in Dallas I couldn't go to. And here I was with this problem, this woman's we're gonna get a divorce. I don't want a divorce. I've offered her an opportunity to leave the house if she wants to. She ain't gonna leave the house. I'm gonna leave the house. That's the deal. And I sat around and thought about that for a while, and I thought, well, somebody, by God, has got to save this family. I guess old Watash is going to have to be the man. So I decided to take the damn test. I didn't tell anybody I'm going to take the test. I didn't hint to anybody I'm going to take the test. I just decided myself I'm going to take the test. Now, I had to change the test a little bit. Two drinks didn't do me any good. But I had a pretty good sized glass. And I figure if I can have three drinks, that'll be okay. Nobody but a prohibitionist, which I generally expected this Al-Anon bunch to be, a bunch of prohibitionists, could fuss at a man for all the pressure I was under, trying those judges, fighting them damn judges down there at the courthouse and dealing with other lawyers, irresponsible clients that were giving me hard times, didn't want to pay my bills, all that good stuff. And three drinks would be okay. Nobody could fuss at that. So I started trying to take the test. Now my awakening began at that point. I never thought about trying to limit the amount I drank. I drank what I needed or what I wanted. So I started trying to take this test. And it was an interesting phenomenon to me. I would come in from work and I would mix myself. I drank martinis at this point in time. I called them deep dish green olive pies. I love them deep dish. There was not vermouth in my deep dish green olive pies. They were mostly Beef Eater's gin. I had worried about drinking poor quality alcohol, so I drank good stuff when I had it. When I didn't have it, I'd just have to drink whatever there was. But anyway, I started out down this road, and I would have that first drink, and it would go down and kind of settle in my stomach. And I'd mix myself another one, and I'd start drinking it, and I'd get down to where it was near the bottom, and shoulders begin to loosen up a little bit, and the music would start. Da 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 da. And out from the phone book would step Superboy. And the same question came to me time and time again. What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was hell no. And I drank the bottle. Now some days when I got home, I knew it had been a bad day. And I'd walk up to the bar, and as I opened up the bar and started to mix that first drink, I'd think, ain't going to be no damn test today. No test today. All tests are off. And then some days I could forget it. But that sponsor of my wife's was something sick. I'll tell you, she told my wife that she should start every day, the moment she became conscious in the morning, she should say aloud and firmly, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Now, when you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, your tongue's got that stuff on it about that thick that you could shave off. One of your eyes has been propped open for about 3 hours there. You got a case of the dry socket. You can't open it any further. You can't close it. Your head, your heart's up in your head, just bang, 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 and there's pain up there, and you hear that. You are reasonably sure you're not going to rejoice a hell of a lot that day. But that's what she did. That's what she did. I gave that test a reasonable chance. I ran it a year and a half. I never passed it one time, not once. I didn't always get knee walking drunk, but I drank more than the three drinks every time I tried it. At the end of that time, I knew that alcohol had me. I didn't have alcohol. And on December 31st of 1972, New Year's Eve, we had two couples, I think, that were going to go out to dinner. I know why we're going to go out to dinner. We're going to go out to dinner because if Jerry gets out and gets a few drinks, it's hard to get him back home again. So we're going to go out and have dinner, and we're going to come back to his house and celebrate New Year's Eve. I had a few days before that, a doctor had told me that my liver, second year in a row, he had told me my liver was acting up poorly. And he showed me the test, and he said, "You see, your liver test is off the wall. You got to quit drinking for 10 days at least before we run another one." I left there knowing full well I was never, ever going back to that doctor. And this night I knew on the first day of, I got up on December 31st, I knew I got to be on my P's and Q's today. Everybody's going to be watching me. I'm going to, by God, last until we get back home, and then probably everybody be a little drunk. So I started out the day. And along about 10 o'clock in the morning, I thought, well, I'll just have a little toddy. Just kind of watch the ball games or whatever I was doing. And so I had mixed myself a little small toddy, and Billy came through the room and said, "You know, remember, we're going out tonight." I said, "I got it. I got it. Don't worry about it. I got it." And I had it. I was watching it. I was in control. And then I woke up in my chair, my green chair. And I looked out the window, and it was pitch black. And my wife sitting over there across from me in a little, her chair, in a robe, reading a little book. They read lots of little books. And I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be going out to dinner?" She said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" And I looked at the clock, and it was about 10:15. I'd passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had no excuse. I wasn't mad at anybody. I had no pressure on me. There wasn't a reason in the world for me to get drunk and pass out. I knew that she had called those people and said, "We can't go to dinner." I also knew that she had said, "And you can't come over here." And being a good Al-Anon, I expected her to say, "And the reason is Jerry's passed out in his chair." I got up and went to the bar and made myself a big drink. I wanted oblivion. I wanted it to go away. I drank the big drink and it worked. I passed out again. And I got up to January the 1st of 1973 on the sorriest looking day I've ever seen in my life. And I sat on the edge of my bed and I thought, "What in the hell are you going to do now?" I remembered what had happened the night before. I knew that those people had been told they couldn't come to my house. I couldn't go to dinner. I was ashamed of that. I had no excuse for that. And I thought, "What are your options? What are your options? You can't pass the damn test. What are your options?" The only thing I hadn't tried was to stop drinking entirely. And that didn't seem like a bad idea that morning. So I went in to shower and cleaned up the best I could and went in. And Billy was cooking breakfast or doing something. And I told her how sorry I was for the night before, and she did not respond favorably to that apology. She didn't hardly acknowledge my presence, as a matter of fact. And I said, Billy, I have decided that I am going to try to stop drinking. She reacted quickly. She turned around and she said, I'm so happy. And she said, she ran over and grabbed a, she happened to have a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And a little 24-hour-a-day book. And she said, you might find these helpful. Would you like for me to call someone for Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, hell no, I wouldn't like you to call somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous. I got myself in this damn mess. I'm going to get myself out. I'm self-reliant. Remember, I'm a West Texan. I'm a man. I don't need no damn AA and A's coming over here and talking to me. So she said something loving and out, and I'm like, you got it, and walked off. And I had it. I didn't know I'd had it, but I had had it. As the day progressed, remarkable things began to happen to my body. I got quick. I sweat. It was January 1st, colder than hell, and I'm sweating. And I'm nervous inside and out. And I'm in the wrong place all the time. If I'm sitting down, I ought to be standing up. If I'm standing up, I ought to be walking. If I'm walking, I ought to be outside walking. If I'm outside walking, I ought to be inside laying down. I'm just moving and grooving. Tried to go to bed that night and I couldn't sleep. Can you believe that? I couldn't sleep. Now, if you're doing something bad for you, to yourself, you ought to, by God, be, when you quit doing it, you ought to get to feeling better, shouldn't you? It didn't happen in my case. It was getting worse the second day. Toward the end of the second day, I knew the third day was coming up. And I realized something. I realized something. If I don't get some help, I'm going to drink tomorrow. I'm going to drink tomorrow. So I snuck back in the kitchen where she had those books. And I'm sorry I didn't read conference-approved literature. I just didn't have time because I didn't want her to catch me. Picked up that little 24-hour book put out by Hazleton and opened it up to January the 2nd. And that day it said, alcohol has ruined your life. And I said, yes, by God, yes, it has. And then it says, this year we're going to turn our drinking problem over to God. I can't tell you how disappointed I was in the solution that they offered me there. I've been to all kinds of churches. I've talked to ministers and rabbis and priests and all kinds of people. I've read books. I've been a spiritual mongrel all my life. I can't find a home. I'm just going from place to place looking for this thing called God. And finally, I had just given up. And there I was going to give my drinking problem to God. And I have no idea why I did what I did next. But I threw that little book out in the middle of the table and said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. I needed to drink just as bad that minute as I did the next. I got up the next morning, and like I said, I know I'm going to drink today unless I get some help. And so, and I knew I needed some help with skin on it. I need some skin on whoever's going to help me. And I did not want to call this AA bunch, but it's the only place I knew to call. I wasn't going to call that club that she'd been going to. She poisoned the well there, just sure as hell. I wasn't going to move in there and try to live all that down. A year and a half bad information, there's no telling what she told them. Anyway, I looked in the telephone book and there was an intergroup place and it sounded kind of like it might be the head place for all the alcoholics in the area or something, so I called that place. And I got hold of the most unsympathetic woman I ever got hold of in my life. I told her that I was a big-time lawyer and that I was trying to quit drinking. And I was having some trouble quitting drinking. And she said, are you going to a meeting every day? And I said, no, I'm not going to a meeting every day. I'm too busy to go to a meeting every day. I don't have time to go to a meeting every day. I'm a very busy lawyer. And she said, well, what do you do in the evening? I said, well, I've been drinking. And she said, well, you're going to have some free time now, aren't you? I said, okay. Where should I go to a meeting? And she said, well, where would you like to go? And I said, well, I'd like to go to a meeting with college graduates near a country club, you know, that kind of a place. She said, we ain't got none of them. So we finally narrowed it down to what we had, which was one little group is called the Town and Country Group. Sounded kind of woodsy to me, you know. I figured, you know, people drove there in station wagons. And nobody would ever think about them being alcoholics. I didn't want to be known as an alcoholic at all. I didn't want to be known as an alcoholic, and I did not want anybody to know I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it was just as bad to be known to go to AA meetings as it was to be drinking. So I needed that secrecy. And I went to that meeting, and there was about eight people there, and they had years and years of sobriety. Nobody had a drinking problem as serious as mine. You can't stay sober as long as they had. If you needed a drink as bad as I needed one the night I went there. And they talked about, you know, they were welcoming me, they were friendly, but I couldn't believe any of them had ever had a real serious drinking problem. And then about 2 weeks later, I hung on for about 2 weeks. They went once a week, whether you needed to go or not. And a guy came in from Heartview, South Dakota, treatment center up there. His name was David P. David came in. He had literature sticking out of every pocket. He had been in treatment for 4 or 5 months. He was something about him being unwilling to do a fourth step. And they just kept him until they finally sweated one out of him. And he sat down in that meeting, and I could tell. Now, this is a real alcoholic I'm looking at here. We're both still quick. And he knew more about alcoholism than anybody I'd ever heard in my life. He could quote from them pamphlets. And he was obviously a real, real ringer here. I'd stumbled onto a guy that knew. So when the meeting was over, I followed him right out. And I said, David, what do you think about this AANA thing? And he said, Jerry, I don't think this is the kind of meeting we need. And I said, oh, what do we need? I thought he's going to say we don't need any at all, but he didn't. He said, we need to get to a group that meets every night. We're going to have to go to meetings every night. We're going to have to get sponsors. We're going to have to do the steps. We're going to have to change the way we think, or we're going to get drunk again. We're going to have to make coffee. What the hell does making coffee have to do with this? And I said, where are we going to go? David has just come in from South Dakota. He don't know where the hell to go. He said, I heard of about a group out on Alpha Road. We'll go out there. Will you go out there with me tomorrow night? I said, I don't know. I'll think about it. Where is it? So he gave me the directions how to get there. And I said, I'll give this some thought tomorrow. Well, what I was doing, I had to look at that place. I had to check it out. I had cased it just like I was going to rob the damn place. That's what I did. I drove by the first time about 55 miles an hour and just glanced at it. I made the block and came back. It was over the top of a 7-Eleven store, a convenience store. And I pulled in and parked, looked up to see if there were surveillance cameras or anybody up there. And didn't seem to be. I went into the place and bought a Slurpee or something. I didn't know. You had to buy something when you were in there. So I bought a Slurpee and I came back out and I checked the surveillance cameras again. It was still clear. I got in my car and I noticed there was a road or street going behind the place or beside the place. And I thought I'd better check out the back. And I went around and pulled around the back, and there it was. There it was. There were 6 parking places in the alley. I could park in the alley and climb the fire escape and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I did. I didn't like it. I didn't like what they did there. The people were overly friendly. They hugged at the drop of a hat. They told horrible stories about themselves. Had the most inappropriate sense of humor I had ever heard of. They laughed like hell at all the bad misfortune that people talked about. They were like high school kids. A guy would get up behind the podium and say, "My name's Jerry," and everybody'd say, "Hi, Jerry." God, it wasn't cool at all. And I got the hell out of there as quick as I could, but I had no place else to go, so I'd go back the next night. And then I began to notice something. I began to notice that those people were pretty happy. They were concerned. Nobody asked me what my job was. Nobody asked me what kind of car I drove, how much money I made. I didn't have to fill out an application form to get in there. They'd ask me questions like, "How are you feeling?" And I'd check the way I felt from my toes up over my head, and I'd say, "Fine." And they'd say, "What step are you working on?" "Step? Working on?" So they explained to me that I needed to begin to process the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had hit a bottom with my drinking. I had reached a point of surrender and acceptance. And I think it's necessary, if you're going to change your life, to find that kind of spot. I think acceptance, surrender, forgiveness are all gifts from God that allow us to go on to something better than where we are. And I accepted them. I admired them. I didn't like all of them, but I admitted that I liked what they did. I watched them closely. I expected somebody was going to come out of the back room soon and tell me what the hell they really did there, because what they were doing couldn't possibly be a solution. And this God thing was all over the wall. Funky little signs. And I told them, finally. I waited for the God squad to come, and they didn't come. So I've always been reasonably aggressive, and I cornered a couple of them that I thought might be high in the hierarchy and told them that I had a little problem with this God thing. And they said, "What's your problem?" And I said, I don't know what to believe about God. I don't have any faith in God. They said, we don't care. We don't care whether you got any faith in it or not. That's up to you. We don't care what your beliefs are about God. What we care about is that you take the steps that we've got on the wall there, do them to the best of your ability, and when you get through with them, you will have had an experience with a power greater than yourself. I said, "I don't think that'll work." He said, "We don't care whether you think it works or not. Just do it." Well, hell, what did I have to lose? I began to try to do it. And I encountered a lot of resistance in this period of time. There were things they told me to do that I just didn't think I needed to do at all. But they told me to do them, and I decided I'll go for it. I think I'll go for it. I mailed a copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, to my mother and father and told them, "I've quit drinking, and this is the way I'm going to try to live the rest of my life." My dad's eyesight was gone by then, and mother read him that book. And they thought it was the best thing that they had ever heard of, better than sliced bread. You know, it was really good. Billy and I began to try to put a marriage back together. And she heard about a guy out in Van, Texas, way to hell out in East Texas. There was a Baptist preacher who's consultant creating some kind of a little seminar or a gathering of people that were having marital problems. She asked me if I'd go, and to show you the depth of my sincerity, I said I would. And even to a Baptist, I was a Methodist, if I was anything at all. I had not been dunked. I had been sprinkled. I was not going to be dunked either, I'll just tell you that for damn sure. So we got out there, and I guess there were 10 or 12 couples there. And we had dinner, and they were just younger people, kind of like we were. And we went into this room that had no chairs in it. We all sat down on the floor, go around the wall, and the guy stood out in the middle, and he said, well, let's get this thing started right. Let's just go around the circle here, start with you, lady. What is God doing for you in your life today? That's a testimonial. Methodists don't do testimonials. Baptists do testimonials. I'm not going to do a damn testimonial. And I would have got up and left, but I would have had to crawl all the way across the floor to get out the door. And Billy wasn't going to go with me. She's going to sit right there. And I thought, surely somebody will pass. Surely somebody will pass. And they went around and nobody was passing. But I'll tell you, they were all civilians as far as I could tell. There's nobody in the program there at all, except me and Billy. And Billy and I guess I should say. And they had piddly little problems. Wimpy little problems. Couldn't drive Central Expressway without God. I had driven Central Expressway drunker and cooter brown for years. They couldn't raise their children without God. I raised my kids just fine without God. And then it occurred to me, I haven't had a drink in 3 months. 3 months I haven't had a drink. I'm a real alcoholic. I'd considered that by then. I read the book because they kept quoting the damn thing and I wanted to be sure they were saying it right, and so I read the book. And I knew I was a real alcoholic. And I thought, you know, if I told these people here, particularly those Baptists, most of them were Baptists, I think, that I had been, was a real alcoholic and had been sober for 3 months, and I guess God had kept me sober, I'd blow the socks off them Baptists. They'd be really impressed with me. Probably they would want to counsel with me after the meeting was over. And I looked carefully around that room to be sure I didn't know anybody there. And I decided, hell, I'll just tell them. And I didn't hear anything for quite a while because I'm rehearsing my speech. I'm getting it all ready to lay it out there in front of them. I'm going to make a big, big impression on them. And it came two people away from me, a big old boy. He's a great big old boy, about 6'4", 6'5", wearing denim clothes, and had a beard, had calluses on the back of his hands where they drug the ground, you know, the kind of guy I'm talking about. He got up, you've seen him. He got up and he started trying to talk, and he made the worst demonstration of manhood I had ever seen in my life. He bawled, he blew his nose, he bubbled, he did every damn thing. I could not make any sense out of what he said whatsoever. His wife, I figure she's his wife, is a pretty little thing sitting next to me. And I know she's embarrassed to death by this demonstration he's putting on. And finally, thank God, he sat down. And she got up. Now, at this point in my sobriety, I still felt pretty bad about having to give up alcohol. What the hell am I going to do on New Year's Eve? What about entertaining clients? Not that I was entertaining any, but just what if I wanted to? What am I going to tell people? What when the firm finds out? If they find out, I'm not going to them damn meetings. And I was really feeling bad about myself there. And she got up and she said, she had gray eyes like my mother's. She said, I couldn't do it without God. Every day, God sustains me. The most wonderful thing about God is that he's always available to everyone, no matter what your race, color, or creed. And he always gives you an opportunity to find him. My children are ages 2 and 3. They'll find God. They'll have the opportunity, even though I'm not going to be there to help them find him. And I realized that as this woman talked, I was listening to a young woman, 32 years of age, who was dying of cancer. Not a long time off, but soon. She was very thin. And her husband, the reason he had been crying was because he was resistant to this. He had a problem with all this. And it suddenly came to me, I had a big thought. I had a big shift in my thinking from self-pity to gratitude. That's a monumental shift. It'll knock you to your knees. God said to me that night, he said, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? All you got to do is go to those meetings and associate with those fine people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can go anywhere and do anything with the same. You have an incurable disease. She has one. But you have a solution that you like better than hers. Yeah. And that was the last night, last time I ever felt sorry for myself for being an alcoholic. Guess what? I'm not sorry for you either. I didn't make my talk that night. I don't know how I got out of the room. I remember I was walking in those pines out there in East Texas, big old tears streaming down my cheeks and snot coming out of my nose, and I was not crying because I was sad. I was crying because I was grateful. I had a way out. I had a way out. And my mother one time, when I was a kid, I watched the town kids. They had bicycles. And I wanted a bicycle. And so I began to politic for one. And finally, my dad ordered one out of the Sears catalog. And the mail carrier brought it out there in a box. And Dad put it together and set it up in the driveway and walked off and said, there it is. Never occurred to me there'd be any problem riding a bicycle. I got out there and I swung up on that bicycle and went right over the top and busted my ass on the other side. I tried to get on that damn thing every way you could, and I couldn't get on it to get stand up and get it going. My mother finally came out, and she had run along, hold me up for a little ways and push me, and I'd roll up and fall over again, you know. Well, at the end of that day, I'd come to a truth. I'd come to a great realization of truth. I'd been sold a defective bicycle. And I explained to my mother and my father that that was a defective bicycle and we're going to have to send it back to Sears and Roebuck. And my mother looked at me and said, Jerry, I haven't ridden a bicycle in years and years and years, but I could ride that bicycle. And I said, with great confidence, you could not. And she said, in the morning, I will show you. So she got up in the morning. We had breakfast. And she said, come on. She put on some slacks and went out, got the bike up. She almost fell the first time. I knew she was going to fall. I didn't really feel sorry for her because I told her about that damn bicycle. But then she kind of kicked it off and got it started, and she wobbled on down the road a little bit. Wasn't pretty, but she was riding that bicycle. And she laid it down and turned around to me and said, okay, now that's all I'm going to do about this bicycle. And went in the house. An hour later, I was riding that damn bicycle. What man has done, man can do. What man has done, man can do. And I watched those people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw what they were doing and how they did it, and I decided I can do this. I can do this, and I can. I took a damned inventory. I asked my sponsor, did you find it necessary to take an inventory? He said, well, hell yes. I read the fifth step. I'm going to have to tell somebody about this damn thing. Why should I bring up all this trash that's floating around in my head here? He said, the reason you do this, Jerry, is not to punish yourself. It's not to make yourself feel bad. It's to learn the lessons that you didn't learn on the way here. Find out what lesson there was in that resentment, what resistance you ran across that you didn't learn a lesson from, you drank away from. What about fears? I didn't think I had any. I'm a West Texas man. West Texas men don't have fears. We hate things, like I hated snakes. I killed everyone I saw. What kind, didn't matter to me what kind it was, but I'd been taught that they were dangerous animals. I don't know whether animals or reptiles, I guess, but they have a bad disposition. If you get close to them, the damn things are likely to bite you, and you can't see them. They lay there in the grass, and they're still, and you can't see them, and I'm bare-legged and both barefooted, and I got to walk through the grass, and I felt a thing called fear. Yeah, I guess I did have some. And from that, I found I had fear all through my life. So I wrote about my fears. Skipped sexual relations because I was married and had two kids and wasn't anything to talk about there, was there? I had to go back later and pick that up. I'll just say. But I laid to rest a lot of things. I found out who I resented. I did the 6 and 7 step the best I could. I prayed about what I'd done to see if I had done it right. I began to make that 8th step list and to determine who I need to make amends to, and I began to make the amends. The result was I made all the amends that I could find any resentment associated with or any reason for me to have any bad feelings about anybody. And the wonderful thing happened to me there. I can today, I promise you this is the truth, I can go in any room in the world and sit down next to anybody in reasonable comfort. I don't have to like them, but I don't fear them. I don't want to avoid them in any way. They're just okay. They got their problems. I got mine. It's okay. It's an enormous freedom. Anytime you begin to live your life with inside your values, it's the greatest freedom you'll ever know. I didn't know that. I had been living to other values. I was looking for material things. I was searching for more, better, and different. I could never quite get there. I'd get there and get what I wanted, and it wasn't the right thing. Like a car. Wanted a car bad. 2 cars. I needed 2 cars. 1 for Billy and 1 for me. My own car. My God, I finally got a car. Real happy for about 2 days. Then I realized, wrong kind of car. I needed a better car, a different kind of car. And I chased more and better and different for a long ways. And I didn't react to the real values of life. My life changed. My life changed in the most significant one I can tell you about was with my mother. My mother got cancer before I got sober. She had ovarian cancer, and they operated on her, and they thought they got it all. And 6 months later, they said they didn't get it all. They had to go back and do it again. And she called me and said, would you come up and sit with me or be with me while they operated on me? And I love my mother. She was always on my team. So I went up there, and I didn't take anything to drink because my mother didn't drink. She died with 75 years of continuous sobriety. She wasn't much impressed with mine. And she had that surgery, and the old family doctor went in to observe it, and he came out before, they hadn't been gone 30 minutes, didn't seem to me like, and he came out and said, boys, it ain't no good. Cancer's all over. It's on her liver, it's on her kidneys, it's just everywhere. She'll be dead in a year. And somebody turned a switch inside my head. And all that resolve not to drink, to not offend her, went away. And I walked out of that hospital and went to a liquor store and bought some vodka. And the rest of the time I was there, I was drinking vodka and coffee or anything else I could get it in, trying to play like I was sober. And they sent me home because I was no use to anybody. Chemotherapy worked for my mom for a while. And after I got sober, I'd been sober about 5 years. They said she's cured. And then one day I got a call from her, and she said, Jerry, they found another lump in my stomach. Would you come up and be with me? And I said, you betcha. So I went up there again. I'd worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous by then. And I went up there again, and I talked to her for a little while. And we were easy and comfortable with each other. I was very concerned, and she was too. She said, Jerry, I want you to get the family in here. I want to talk to them. So I rounded up everybody that was in the hospital, and she said, folks, I've been fighting this thing for a long, long time. I'm weaker now than I've ever been, and I don't know how this is going to come out. I don't know whether I'm going to make it or not. I know it's going to be very difficult for me, and I know it's going to be very difficult for each of you. And while this is going on, lean on Jerry. He'll be your strength. And I was. My mother was operated on. There was nothing they could do. It took her 2 weeks to die. They were horrible weeks. She was out of it most of the time. And it was just a nightmare. My dad blew a big ulcer while she was just right at the end of her life, and they had to take out most of his stomach. And I had the whole dang thing just kind of round up and wind up, and told my dad one night, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, we were going home. I said, Dad, I got to tell you something I did that you probably feel bad about, but I asked God to take Mom. I don't think she'll ever have any quality of life, and I don't want to see her suffer anymore. He said, Jerry did the same thing. She died within about an hour of that. And Dad didn't go to the funeral. He was still in the hospital. And after I got everything all taken care of sitting around thinking about this period of time, and I suddenly realized that not one second, not one minute ever did I think about taking a drink. The disease of alcohol had been set aside for me. I had found that I had a strength with a higher power that could carry me through a day at a time, whatever came along. You can't keep that going all the time. I got cancer a little while back, leukemia. They told me I might live 5 years, might not make it that long. Found a disease, they found, gave me some medicines, a new medicine, really good medicine. Then I got prostate cancer and had an operation for that, had an ulcerated colon, and I had to take out part of my colon. Things were just piling up on me, and I was every day thinking about dying. And one morning I sat on the edge of my bed, and I thought, I'd be damned if I'm going to spend another day, a good day, worrying about when I'm going to, by God, die. It'll just happen when it's going to happen. I'm going to go play golf or do whatever I want to do today, and I'm not going to think another thing about it. And most days I can do that. I don't deserve any credit for that. I don't deserve any credit for that. I don't know how many people here tonight are new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know there must be some. And I just want you to know that you can get sober and hang around AA, and the fellowship will keep do you some good for a while. But the fact of the matter is, unless you get all the way in and do it all, you're going to miss the best part of your life. You're going to miss the part where you're happy, joyous, and free, and where you can handle whatever the hell comes down the road. And that's worth fighting for. That's worth taking the time to get after it. You got an opportunity. Each person in this room has got an opportunity that few people in the world really have. You have the ability to reach and help another alcoholic or the families of alcoholics. The doctors, they can't really do it. They'll just roll pills at you till you go goofy with that.